All right. Don't mind it. Is it better? See, the problem is when I start moving my hands, and you can't talk without your hands. There isn't enough space for it. It's just Marina Rushley. So, well, today our topic is weddings. And there's a lot one can say about weddings, and there's not much time in half an hour to say much about weddings. But you know what they do say, a man is incomplete until he is married, and then he is finished. Well, Baruch Hashem, I've been married for 20 years, and I've learned what is the secret of a long marriage. You have to take time. You have to take time to go to a restaurant twice a week, with candlelight, dinner, soft music. She goes on Tuesdays, I go on Wednesdays. Which does not contradict what I heard once from Rabbi Lepra, Zichrono Livracha, who asked, why is it that Sukkot is called Zaman Simchaseinu, the time of rejoicing? She's in the house while I'm in the sukkah. Okay, all right, well, leading up to the actual wedding, before one gets to the wedding, I found an interesting and unusual shaila brought in the She'arim Tzionim Bahalacha. And he asks the question about if one is allowed to be mevatel shidduch, to cancel an engagement, if it turns out that the bride has lied to him about her age. A rather unusual question to find in the halacha. I know of a person once who was dating, and she told him that she was 26, and she by chance happened to leave her passport lying around when he discovered that she was much older. And interestingly enough, there is a tshuva of this in the Chasam Sofer. The Chasam Sofer speaks about it in Chelek Vav Simen Mem Zayin, and says if she is 40 years old or older, then definitely one is fully entitled to cancel the engagement without any compensation, because that is the time when her childbearing age would start decreasing. The shaila is also asked by the Tshuvas David Meshorim, who is brought a shaila where she said that she was 28 and she was really 38, and he said there is a mekach tos here, there is a just like misrepresentation in a sale of goods act, and he is entitled to cancel the shidduch. Doesn't talk about when he lies about her age, only talks about when she lies about her age. Now, I'm not quite sure why that is. The Chelkas Yaakov writes in Chelek Aleph Kuf Ayin Zayin, he says, if she's more than 5 years out in what she says, then one is entitled to cancel. Otherwise, he would not regard it as a mekachtos. Okay. So we come nearer and nearer to the marriage when they finally decide to get engaged. And he brings her home, and the parents look at this proposed partner of his or of hers and think, my God, how can you choose such a person? The Ramah deals with this at the end of Simon Reish Mem. What if the father says to the son, you are not going to marry this girl? Or it's possible that he might say to his son, you are going to marry this girl, and he says, Dad, I just can't possibly live with such a thing. What is the din? What is the din? Do we say that the person is liable for kibbutz to honour his father and honour his mother, and he has to do what they say? Or does he think, crumbs, I've got to live my whole life with her in order to this, I've just got to do what I'm told? The Ramah makes it perfectly clear that the son or the daughter do not have to listen to their parents when it comes to the choice of a wedding partner. Chayimav Moche Babeni says this, Eza Isha Sheyachpots, and his heart desires her. Sheyachpots Haben, Ein Tzorech Nishma Elav. So what is the definition of honouring parents? If the parents say you should not marry this girl, or you should marry this girl, then what is the idea of honouring parents? My Rosh Yeshiva once explained this in a very interesting way. He said, honouring isn't doing everything that they tell you to do. What if father says to you, be a doctor, or don't be a doctor? Do you have to listen if you just feel it's not the right thing for yourself? The way to honour one's parent is to bring your dad his newspaper and his slippers and his pipe and explain to him in a very nice and respectful way why you feel unable to concur with his request. That is kibbutz. You do not have to ruin your whole life just in order to fulfill their desires about whom you marry or whom you don't marry. So the Schutz of the Noda Behuda says that this din applies not only then to the son, but also to the daughter, because the Ramah doesn't make it very clear about the daughter. And he says also the girl can say, I do not wish to marry this man, or I do wish to marry this man. And the parents are not entitled to stop it. I knew once of a case where the parents tried to stop their daughter marrying a Sephardi, not because they were racist or anything, but because they felt that the backgrounds were not compatible and so on and so forth, and the couple were very devoted to each other. These things are unfortunate to hear about. There are many happy marriages between Ashkenazim and Sephardim. However, it does say though, in the Shevet Halevi, says that if there is something not hogun, something not proper about this proposed partner, and the Steich Hemed says the same thing, that if there is something clear-cut about the reputation or the bad character of a proposed bride or groom, then, says the Steich Hemed, it is correct for the child to listen to the advice of the parents. There is also a concept of lifnim meshuras hadin, that even though me'ika hadin, one doesn't have to listen to the parents, nevertheless, it's a good idea to try and, he says, make some compromise. I don't know how you can compromise about not marrying or marrying somebody. But he says that one could try to accommodate the wishes of the parents as much as is possible in order to create that bridge and so on. Okay, so that is a very important issue which does come up a lot nowadays. So then we come to the actual wedding. Well, the music is now playing, and it's very loud, of course. The wedding day, I was once accompanying a chosan on the morning of his wedding day, and he needed a lot of reminding about, have you got this ready and have you got that ready, because he was suddenly very forgetful and nervous. And, pardon?
When to turn up?
Yes, when to turn up. It's true. Come on, get dressed. Oh, I got loads of time. No, let's hurry up. The chosan then was asked by me, well, where is the ring? Oh, I've got the ring, no problem. Here it is. I said, Tim, where did you get the ring? Oh, I got it from so-and-so, from, he lives around the corner, and I said, have you paid him for it? No, he said it's all right, it can wait, it's okay. I said, well, does this ring belong to you? Well, he sold it to me. I said, yes, but you haven't paid for it. What sort of kinyan have you made on it? And half an hour before the chuppah, I personally went round to the person from whom he bought it, and paid on his behalf the money. Well, I made him write out a check. Even though the check hasn't cleared yet, that is a Maisa Kinyan according to the poskim, and he paid. So with all the fuss of weddings when it comes to the flowers, and the photographers, and the video, what we really have to make sure about is that the Kiddushin is tofsin, that the wedding is effective. And therefore, one of the first questions to ask is, does the Chosan own the ring? Obviously, many rabbis who are Masadi Kedushin go through the motions, and they do usually say to the Chosan, does this ring belong to you? Now, I was once the best man at a wedding. Sorry? It is. Well, I did find in one of the poskim, what if he couldn't afford a ring yet, or get hold of a ring, and it comes to the wedding day, can he borrow one from a woman who wears one? No, he can't, but a woman can makne to him a ring and say, here, I give this to you as a matana, and then he can use it. The understanding is eventually he'll replace it with another and give that to her, but there has to be a Maisa Kinyan. What? Yes?
The Kinyan itself is, did the purchase be done by the chef who earned the money, or the father purchased it for him, or the mother?
If the father buys the ring for the son, yes, that's not enough, because then the ring belongs to the father.
Exactly.
The ring has to belong to the chosan.
So the chef has to actually earn the money to buy the ring.
He has to do a kinyan.
He
can give his son the money and say, you buy yourself a ring, and the son makes a kinyan on the ring. But if he doesn't own the ring, then they're not married.
So what's the difference between a woman in the audience who gives the ring?
Well, there has to be a Maisa Kinyan. Now, there are a number of recognised forms of Kinyan. A Kinyan Hagbor, especially in front of Adim,
so
might
father,
be a Kinyan.
So in that case, the father-in-law,
if he gives a matana, present...
Of the ring
or of the money to the son, that's fine. A present is good enough, because that is still then ownership.
He has his own money.
Right.
Does he... At the time of the day of the chuppah, before the chuppah,
where he used to give him the Kenyan with a handkerchief.
That was a Kenyan on the Kasuba, not on the ring.
Right. When the Chosin accepts upon himself...
Well,
when the Chosin accepts upon himself all the duties of the Ksuva, and there's a Kenyan involved, then he does a Khalifin, or he lifts up the handkerchief in front of Adam. That is also called a Kenyan. So he's accepting upon himself the obligations of the Ksuva. Now, I was once the best man at a wedding, which was under the auspices of the Hendon Hadass Yisrael Synagogue, and Rabbi Roberts was Masadik of Kiddushin. And being the best man, I had the privilege of carrying in my pocket the ring. But not just the ring that the Chosin is going to give to the Kala. The Kala, incidentally, decided that she was going to give a ring to the Chosin. And I had this box in my pocket with two rings in it. And rather stupidly, when Rabbi Roberts asked to see the ring, I took out this box with two rings. And he got the shock of his life. Because first of all, he was worried which ring belongs to the Chosin, if either. Secondly, if the Kala's giving him a ring, there can be further complications. There can be confusion, as I said, which ring is which. Number two, there is also the question of, is the whole kingdom he is giving to her valid if they are exchanging rings? Because a lot of goyim do this, they exchange rings. If a chosin and kala exchange rings, then really the maisa kiddushin of he and being koneha is not necessarily taking effect. It is a swap. And therefore, there is a big shaila about the validity of the marriage if she gives him a ring. And there are a number of poskim who write, the Igris Moshe writes about this, that definitely she may not give him a ring under the chuppah if she wants to give him a ring. If she does, there is a question about the validity of the marriage completely. Right. Now, he says that if she wants to give him a ring, she can give him a present after the chuppah. After he's done the Maisa Kinyan, they can go in the Yichud room, she can give him a ring, and that's perfectly all right. What is the reason? Well, they're exchanging their vows or whatever it is. But the Igris Moshe writes that there is an inyan of a v'chukah seim lo seleichu, v'chukah segoi, because this is a widespread non-Jewish practice. He says it's also under the chuppah. And there's another problem that when people see her giving him a ring, people might say that is the kiddushin, or that the two of them are mekadesh each other, and that invalidates the kiddushin completely. So they have to be very careful that if she does give him a ring, it has to be later, and it is just a mere present from her to him. Well, we're under the chuppah, and because there are crowds of people, and it might be outdoors, then there is a microphone being used, and the shayla is brought in the poskim as to the validity of hearing the seven brachos via a microphone. You see, the chosin really has the duty to say the brachos himself. But because we don't want to embarrass him, and not every chosin is able to, then he is really delegating that duty to the rabbi who is organizing the study of the kedushin. Now, what if a microphone is being used? There are poskim who deal with this when it comes to blowing the shofar and hearing the megillah, so that you cannot do these things, say, on a radio or via a microphone, because you are not listening to the actual kol, the actual sound. You are listening to sound waves, which are a reflection of it. The same applies if you listen to something on the telephone. Can you say on name to a bracha that you hear on the telephone? You're not really hearing the bracha. So the poskim deal with this in quite a wide way. The question is that at the chuppah or the sheva brachas, and at the dinner when the sheva brachas are made, can one be yotza the mitzvah of making those seven blessings via a microphone? The problem is really derived from a machlokas in the Rishonim. Not that they had microphones in those days, but the Rambam says that the brachas of the sheva brachas are brachas hamitzvahs. It's a bracha on the mitzvah of the marriage. However, the Rosh disagrees. The Rosh says that the sheva brachas are not necessarily brachas on the mitzvah of the marriage. The sheva brachas are brachas shvach. Shvach meaning praise. Just like you praise God when you make a bracha over the blossoms on the tree in the springtime, you are praising God. It's not a bracha on the mitzvah, like I say, on the tzilas lulav. Therefore, according to the Rambam, the bracha is on the mitzvah where there's a direct necessity for the chosin to say or delegate those brachas in order to fulfill the mitzvah. Then there is a question on whether the mitzvah has been performed if he can't hear those brachas. However, if it's a bracha on the shvach, it's a praise bracha. This says the Rosh in Gemara Ksuvos in the first perek. Tosfos brings this in Pesachim Daf Zayin, that even if the chosan did not hear the brachas, it's okay, he's yotza. What is generally the held minag is that the chosan will be able to hear because of his close proximity to the one who's making the brachas. So even though it's coming through on a microphone, he is hearing as well the sound coming directly because he's in hearing distance, and therefore he's okay. The question though is whether a deaf person then, can a deaf person have the bracha said for him, if it's a bracha on the mitzvah? And a deaf or a dumb person would be unable to say the brachas, yet alone delegate and hear them. And the question is asked by Rabbi Akiva Reger on Yeridea, on the Taz in Yeridea Siman Aleph, that the kiddushin of a cheresh, you do make the bracha for a deaf person. Because the generally accepted view is that these are brachas of shvach. So for a deaf and dumb person, you make the brachas, and therefore, if you don't hear the brachas with a microphone, okay, it's still all right. But it is the common practice now to bring people, try and bring people at the wedding dinner close to the chosan and kala. Not that the microphone is schlepped around all over the hall, so that it's done just simply through the microphone. But if the people who are saying the brachas can come up to the top table where the chosan and kala are sitting, then there is some hope that they will hear the brachas properly from the people who are reciting it, rather than from the amplification system. Right. A hearing aid, in many cases, is amplifying sound where you might hear it slightly in any case. So the same principle may apply. If a person comes to shul and listens to the Megillah and listens to the shofar, the question there is much more important. They're not brachas of shvach. There is the actual, the hearing of the Megillah is the mitzvah. The hearing of the shofar is the mitzvah. And the generally held view there is, it's probable that he will be able to hear something without the hearing aid. And the hearing aid is really amplifying. A person who's totally stone deaf will not be able to use a hearing aid. And then a person is honest. He can't help it. He can't do the mitzvah. There's nothing, just like a blind person can't say Bromi Arioish in Havdalah. And the person who's got no sense of smell can't make a bracha over the basomim, the spices, in Havdalah. The person is then honest. So we're under the chuppah, and everything is really a wonderful atmosphere, the chazan's singing, the crowds assembling, the flowers adorning. But what is the most important thing of all? Something which is frequently overlooked, and that is, you have to have two kosher witnesses. And when I say kosher, it doesn't mean you can eat them. It means that they have to be people who are shomrei Torah and mitzvahs. The two men who are appointed to be Avim, it says, should be free from all aveira, because a person who commits sins is not able to become a witness. And therefore, well, everybody might have some stigma on themselves from something they've done wrong. So therefore, the Avim, before they carry out their duty, they should be mahare b'tshuva. They should have in mind that they're doing teshuva, repentance, for all and any sins that they have done in the past. So that they are perfectly pure at the time when they are witnessing the event. A year ago I was in Switzerland and I was invited to a wedding where the rabbi who was Masadeh Kiddushin was invited from Israel. So he wasn't familiar with the local people, and the father of the chosan or the kala chose couple of Avim, and after the chuppah, a local rabbi went up to the rav, who was Masadeh Kiddushin, and said, look, I'm sorry to tell you this, but one of the Avim whom you picked, he's not a Shomer Shabbos. Everybody knows he's not a frum fellow. And the rabbi who came from Israel was in a bit of a quandary as to what to do. He was flying back to Israel the following morning, and everything was underway with the dancing and so on. So he mentioned it to a close relation, thinking, oh well, let them sort it out. And this close relation came up to me and said, Eli, what are we going to do about this? I should handle such problems. The only reason one doesn't become a communal rabbi is because one doesn't want to have to be paid for worrying about this. So what's the deal? Now, there is, in fact, a tshuva of Moshe Feinstein about when you don't have kosher edom at weddings, what do you do? And he does mention a chasam sofer, a very famous chasam sofer in Siman Kuf, Kuf Aleph of his tshuvas, which is that if the two edom were not fully compliant with all the rules, there are other people standing around who will be witnessing the event, and we can rely on the chasam sofer's view that those people can be counted as edom as well, and therefore the marriage is valid. However, not everybody likes to rely on the chasam sofer. In particular, if the wedding is held, say, on a bima, which is higher up, and you've got all the photographers and video men crowding round, and other people can't actually see the ring going on the finger. The question also arises in Reb Moshe Feinstein's Tshuvas on the subject of reform weddings, when the witnesses are people who are Mechallelim Shabbos, the Mechallelim Shabbos B'Fahesia, and the people generally around there are who do not hold by the Torah Shebiksav or the Torah Shebalpeh, and the so-called minister, rabbi, who is officiating, does not hold by various mitzvahs HaTorah, as well as virtually all the mitzvahs to Rabbanon. And when the Kiddushin is given, the man says to the woman, "Hurry up, Mekudesha, sleep at Abbas, Zu, Kados, Moshe of Yisrael." And what does it mean, Kados, Moshe of Yisrael? According to all the din of the Torah and all the dinim of the rabbis. And the validity of that marriage, says the Igris Moshe, is nil. And this is very helpful, in fact, because if afterwards they separate or divorce, and then she remarries, and there's the problem about Mamzerus and Eshesish, and so on, according to Reb Moshe Feinstein, there's no problem, because she was never married in the first place. But on the subject which I was involved in, I spoke to a local rabbi, I spoke to Rav Chaim Halpern about it, and he said, look, but yeah, but it is okay to rely on the chasam sofer, who holds there other people standing around, who witness the event. But it's preferable, if they could come into your house afterwards, and in front of you and somebody else, that's assuming that I'm a kosher witness, and he does it again, he puts the ring on a finger, you don't have to do the brachas again, you don't have to have another party again with all the expense, he can put the ring on the finger again, hurry up mekudeshesli, etc., and that's all right. Well, yeah, well, Reb Chaim held that it doesn't matter about the ksuvah, you don't have to do it again, because he's already accepted upon himself the duties of the ksuvah, and the duties of the ksuvah you accept upon yourself before the marriage takes place. So it doesn't invalidate that. You don't have to go through any of the other formalities again. Yeah, well, that's another question. The problem is that the Chosson and Kala felt very reluctant to do this. Number one, because it were a kind of stress to me. So you've got to, everything you do must make sure there's no machlokas, no arguments, because you will upset somebody in all this. The parents of the Chosson and Kala will be very offended if it turns out that they're told that what they organised was no good, and there could be a lot of arguments and upsetting, and we mustn't allow that to happen. That's the first thing. Second thing is, if you bring in the Chosson and Kala quietly and explain to them, ideally they should do what you do. Chosson, though, said to me that he was aware of the problem and he had discussed it with his rabbi, and he felt that he didn't want to do anything about it because it made them feel as though what happened then was no good. It made them feel that if she has already conceived, and she had already conceived, that they will feel as though their child is born out of wedlock, and they didn't want to go ahead with this. But one can do so much and no more. Ideally, one must make sure from the outset that the edim are reliable, kosher witnesses.
Not related.
And they're not related. That's another shaila which comes up.
Why do we historically only take two edim? Why don't we take three or four? And then that way, if you've got a problem with one, you've already got others to rely
on. Yeah, because there have to be two edim, it is the practice to discount others, so much so, it is regarded by some poskim as if nobody else we call an aide, and therefore nobody else is qualified. And that's the argument against the chasam sofer. Because if you appoint two aidim, then nobody else are aidim. I was once invited to a geirus, but I was asked by the dayanim to stay outside, because they wanted three dayanim present as three witnesses, and they didn't want four or five people standing there, so that particular number was the number.
because other than institute a declaration by the agent, which is such an important and key thing to have in your mind with the issue when you're showing the mitzvahs.
They don't have to make a declaration, but to be Maharev b'tshuva, to think teshuva is enough to qualify for being an aide. The question about a relation is brought up by the Shalos Tshuvos of the Shevet Halevi. He does bring up that if a relation talks about in Chelek Yud, which has only just recently come out, Simon Reish Mem Gimel, he says when it turns out that one of the Eidim was a relation, he says I can rely on the Chasam Sofer, who talks about other people watching, and he discusses if Eidus, without actually seeing the ring going on the finger, but you know that the ring has gone on the finger, is that good enough? And there's no suffix, there's no doubt about the Maisa, but it does come back to the problem that some poskim don't accept the Chasam Sofer, and therefore maybe it should be done again.
I heard once that he said that all people should not go to a reform wedding because they may validate this word that is otherwise invalid.
That is correct. There is always the risk at a reform wedding if you feel liable to come along. I mean, it is a problem if your partner in your firm or your boss is making a wedding and you feel you have to go along, and it would look very bad on you in your reputation, in your work, if you don't go along, so you have to go along. If you are then witnessing the event, my advice is slip outside while the actual kiddushin takes place, and then come back in again for the music. There is also an interesting story told about Reb Moshe Feinstein, who was once being asked to be Masadik Kedushin at a wedding, and the mother of Hassan came up to him half an hour before the chuppah was due to start and said, "Rabbi, I have to speak to you privately." "Yes, okay." He took her into a room and she burst into tears and she said, "Look, I have a confession to make. Nearly 14 years ago, I was Mazaneh. I had an affair, and this son of, sorry, not 14, no, no 20 odd years ago, or whatever it was, I had an affair, and the chosen today is a product of that affair, and is not a son of my husband." So Reb Moshe hardly flinched and said, "Did you tell anybody else about this?" She said, "No, I haven't told ever anybody else. Nobody else knows about it. Did anybody see what happened? Did anybody see you having an affair with somebody else?" She said, "No, it was kept totally secret and nobody at all knew about it." So he said, "Okay, we're carrying on now with the chasna." Why did he say that? It needed a very bold rabbi like Reb Moshe Feinstein to say this. You know, some rabbis might say, "Well, we have to suspend the proceedings, we have to carry out some inquiries." But Moshe said there are no eidim, he said to his pupils. There were no witnesses to the event that she was Mazaneh, that she committed a crime of Eish HaTish. And as there were no witnesses, every Jew has a chazok of being a kosher Jew, that there is no question about Mamzerus here whatsoever, because there is no eidus. And he went ahead with the wedding. I mean, when you think about it, if the woman was opposed to the shidduch and she wanted to stop his son marrying a particular girl, it was a brilliant device if she would have wanted to stop it from going ahead. But she did not succeed. Well, just a few more points. There's so much one can talk about when it comes to weddings. Just a few hints, which are not really halachas, which we're going to talk about. I always find it amazing under the chuppah when they bring out the wine, and it's always a bottle of red wine. And I think I feel so sorry for the bride, because if the wine is spilt on her, it'll cause enormous embarrassment to her for the rest of the day. And therefore, I just can't understand why people don't use white wine for the wedding. I was interested to note in recent copies of the Jewish press from America that a number of rabbonim have signed an edict forbidding very loud music at weddings. Deafening music, which seems to have become very fashionable, and that they would refuse to come to such weddings if it's very loud. Now, another idea which is... Grape juice is okay. There is a shayla in the poskim that if there's no wine around, can you use beer? If there's no wine, you are allowed to use sheikha, you can use beer, but you just say shehakel instead of a ber priya gofen. The poskim agree that nowadays, if a woman is not ready yet for going to the mikveh, can the marriage take place? And the poskim agree that the marriage can take place. The kiddushin is tofsin, that the marriage is effective. So she's got to count the days, 7 clear days, after she ceases her period, and then she goes to the mikveh. Now, what if it didn't work out and the dates clashed because the wedding was booked a year beforehand because they needed the hall and the orchestra and the caterer? So all this was booked well in advance, and then the pattern of events changed. Some Hasidim have the practice not to send out the wedding invitations until about 3 weeks beforehand, when they got the all clear, so to speak, from the cousin. I shouldn't have used that term. But the question is, in the poskim, whether it's a valid marriage, it is. Although there is a minhag that afterwards they do a further yichud, that when she finally goes to the mikveh, that they have yichud, because part of the wedding ceremony is afterwards when they go to the yichud room and they sit there for 2 minutes on their own. In fact, I was once asked to go into a yichud room before the chosan and kala arrived inside it, because it was a chupas nidah, and that they shouldn't be alone together, and I was told to hide so that the eidim don't see me. And one of the eidim, who was a member of this shul, actually said to the rabbi, "Hey, wait a minute, I'm sure I saw somebody through there." And the rabbi said, it's okay, don't worry. Nowadays, there isn't really an excuse for having a chuppah nidah, because as my Rosh Hashiva once said, a girl 2-3 months before, and ideally if she thinks there may be a problem, she can go to the doctor, she can get medication to regulate matters, that there isn't a chuppah nidah, because it's a great inconvenience. Although it's not against the din, it's a great inconvenience, because they have to keep away from each other until she's out for mikveh, and it does spoil the day emotionally. They're not allowed to sleep in the same house together after the wedding, unless he sleeps in the same room as somebody else and she sleeps with somebody else. It's terribly inconvenient. So one should do everything possible, just as a practical hint, to avoid having a chuppas nidah. And one should know that the yichud room is as important for eidim purposes as the kiddushin itself. Some people, especially the photographers and certain rabbis with respect, have the tendency after 2 minutes to say, "Okay, time up," and in they go to the yichud room. And I don't see why they have to do that. If the minimum is 2 minutes, okay, then stay outside for 2 minutes. But afterwards, you know, this couple have been waiting for each other for so long, leave them alone for 10 minutes, for 20 minutes, as long as they want. Well, that's the way things are. Yeah. Anyway, I think my time is up now, so I will end off by saying that anyone who is making a wedding in the near future or in the distant future, it should be b'shar tov and matzlachas, with all the things going smoothly and without the problems of all the arrangements. Our next talk comes to the next stage of life in our life cycle, when we shall be talking about wills. Thank you very much.